This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 77 to 78 of chapter Al-Hajj from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون. يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون. وجاهدوا في الله حق جهاده هو اجتباكم وما جعل عليكم في الدين من حرج ملة أبيكم إبراهيم وسماكم المسلمين من قبل وفي هذا ليكون الرسول شهيدا عليكم وتكونوا شهداء على الناس وسماكم المسلمين من قبل وفي هذا ليكون الرسول شهيدا عليكم وتكونوا شهداء على الناس فأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واعتصموا بالله هو مولاكم فنعم المولى ونعم النصير. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. O you who believe, bow down and prostrate yourselves and serve your Lord and do good that you may succeed. and strive hard in the way of Allah, such striving as is due to Him. He has chosen you and has not laid upon you any hardship in religion. The faith of your father Ibrahim, he named you Muslims before, and in this, that the apostle may be a bearer of witness to you, and you may be bearers of witness to the people. Therefore, keep up prayer and pay the poor rate, and hold fast by Allah. He is your guardian. How excellent the guardian, and how excellent the helper.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
the headlines this hour. The Kremlin says Russia will not resume participation in the new START nuclear arms reduction treaty until Washington listens to Moscow's position. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his country can only defend its skies if its Western allies provide Kiev with fighter jets. And North Korea's leader orders government officials to engineer what he calls fundamental transformation in agricultural production amid fears of food shortages. Thanks for joining us. Russia says it will not rejoin a key nuclear arms reduction treaty until the West changes its attitude toward Moscow. The Kremlin spokesman said NATO has now turned into Russia's enemy by arming Ukraine. Dmitry Peskov added that the security of one country cannot be ensured at the expense of the security of another. Last week, President Vladimir Putin announced Russia's decision to suspend participation in the new START treaty. He cited Washington's failure to keep its end of the bargain and its deepening involvement in the Ukraine war. The U.S. called the move deeply unfortunate and irresponsible. The new START treaty was signed between the U.S. and Russia in 2010. It puts a limit on nuclear devices and the means of their delivery. Russia has accused the United States and other Western countries of disrupting its relations with Africa. Russia says the move by, quote, the collective West is aimed at isolating Moscow, following what it calls a special military operation in Ukraine.
The U.S. desire to dominate the world by poking its nose into other countries' affairs, especially when things are not in its favor, is not hidden anymore. In the latest example, Russia has come out accusing Washington of attempting to disrupt its relations with nations on the African continent. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov said the United States and its allies are conducting an unprecedented campaign for Russia's political and economic isolation, including the disruption of the second Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg scheduled for July. Bogdanov said Western countries embarked on their collective campaign to isolate Russia in the international arena ever since the beginning of this special military operation in Ukraine. He noted that the West, in order to achieve its anti-Russia agenda, has significantly piled up pressure on African countries through threats of imposing sanctions, termination of financial and humanitarian aid. Bogdanov's assessment came more than a month after Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited South Africa as part of his African tour. During Lavrov's visit to Pretoria, which was the second since last year, the two sides pledged to boost bilateral ties. In a joint presser, top South African diplomat Naledi Pandor even lauded the growing economic partnership between the two countries, along with political, economic, social, defense, and security cooperation. Lavrov's successful visit to the continent and planned Russia-Africa summit and economic forum in July are testimonies that West, the U.S. in particular, have failed in their plots to isolate Russia internationally.
The U.S.'s approach toward Russia comes at a time when millions of Africans appear to be fed up with Western presence on their soil. That can be highlighted in recent anti-West sentiment in such countries like Burkina Faso, where protesters demanded immediate withdrawal of French forces. With anger growing in Africa against the West, it seems that the era of Western colonialism is taking its last breaths.
The visit by the Russian diplomat to South Africa refurbished the common pursuit of the two countries for upholding world peace and security and promoting global development and prosperity. With South Africa hosting the Summit of Five Emerging Economies, commonly known as BRICS, this year, the ruling African National Congress has suggested that Pretoria could use the chairmanship to push for the admission of new members to expand the bloc and challenge a global arrogance. In the words of Pandor herself, the current global geopolitical tensions clearly signal the need to create institutional mechanisms that will have the stature from the global trust to promote and support global peace and security. BRICS should play a proactive role in emerging processes and ensure it is part of a redesigned global order. recent joint naval drills involving South Africa, Russia, and China, despite U.S. criticism, show these countries' resolve to stand against the global dominance of some powers. Pandor argued that hosting such maneuvers with what she called friends were part of the natural course of relations. Nevertheless, the popular resentment against the West, the U.S., the U.K., and France in particular, are on the rise due to their historic oppression on the continent. Anti-West sentiment could be clearly seen in nationwide protests in Burkina Faso, with demonstrators condemning former colonizer France while waving Russian flags. Growing dissatisfaction with France is largely visible in other former colonies across Africa, including Mali. At this moment, the unity is an anti-colonial power structure seemed to be of high urgency for African nations. A change from unipolar to multipolar arrangement is another need, especially for East African countries that are embroiled in power politics. These could uplift not only the continental stature, but a unified power to reckon with. However, this major paradigm shift can be duly achievable if countries across the African continent come together and stand firm against the West imperialism.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky reiterates his plea to his Western allies to provide his country with fighter jets to defend the skies.
Our pilots and anti-aircraft units and other experts of our Air Force are doing a great job, but we will be able to completely protect our skies when the aviation taboo is fully lifted in relations with our partners.
Zelensky's request to shore up his country's air forces comes as the West remains undecided to provide Kiev with warplanes. Ukraine has been given billions of dollars in military aid by its Western backers. The U.S. and some European countries also announced to equip Kiev with their main battle tanks. Washington has said that it will send an additional $1.2 billion in financial aid to Kiev. The announcement was made by the U.S. Treasury Secretary during her visit to Ukraine. Janet Yellen said the U.S. would also press for more action from its allies to support Ukraine in its war with Russia. Washington has been the biggest supplier of arms to Kiev since the war broke out. Ukraine says there's no sign that China is mulling transfer of weapons to Russia despite U.S. claims. The head of Ukraine's military intelligence, Kirill Budanov, also expressed a doubt that the Chinese officials have even talked about the issue. U.S. officials recently accused China of considering providing Russia with lethal military equipment. Beijing denied the claims, saying it is the U.S. that is sending arms to the conflict zone, not China. It also slammed Washington for imposing sanctions against its companies over allegedly providing intelligence to the Russian army.
The actions of the United States have no basis in international law at all, nor are they authorized by the UN Security Council. They are typical illegal unilateral sanctions and long-arm jurisdiction which seriously damage China's interest. China is strongly dissatisfied and firmly opposed to this and has lodged stern representation with the U.S.
Well, also about resolute countermeasures by China. The spokesperson added that the U.S. must stop spreading disinformation and withdraw sanctions on Chinese companies. China has repeatedly called for peaceful resolution of the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. It has also recently unveiled a 12-point position paper on the political settlement of the crisis. Russia says conditions are currently not in place to peacefully resolve the war in Ukraine after a Chinese proposal for a political settlement. The Kremlin says it has paid, quote, a lot of attention to the plan by its Chinese friends. Last week, Beijing released a 12-point paper calling for a comprehensive ceasefire, peace talks, and respect for all countries' territorial sovereignty. China also demanded an end to unilateral sanctions on Russia and criticized NATO expansion. Russia says any settlement of the conflict needs to recognize its control over the four Ukrainian regions it annexed last year. It also wants Ukraine to renounce its bid to rejoin or to join NATO. Kiev, meanwhile, says it's open to parts of the Chinese plan, but has stressed that it will not agree to any peace without the return of all of its territory. The United States has joined Canada and the European Union in imposing a ban on a Chinese video sharing social networking service, TikTok. The White House says federal agencies have been asked to remove and disallow installations of the application on devices operated by their staff. The deadline is set to comply with an order issued by Congress. The ban does not apply to businesses not associated with the federal government or to millions of private citizens. However, the American Civil Liberties Union says the House is discussing a bill to effectively ban TikTok for everyone. The rights group says this would be stripping Americans from the constitutional rights to freedom of expression. Canada and the EU have also banned TikTok from their devices. TikTok, which has 1 billion users globally, has rejected accusations of sharing data with the Chinese government. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has called for a fundamental transformation in agricultural production, as the country is reportedly grappling with food shortages. Kim emphasized the importance of stabilizing agricultural sector, saying hitting grain production targets this year is a top priority. He did not elaborate on measures that the country would take, but said the changes need to happen over the next few years. Kim was speaking during the second day of a key party meeting on Monday. His remarks came weeks after South Korea's unification ministry claimed there had been reports of starvation deaths in the north. Pyongyang is under strict international sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs, and this has been compounded by a self-imposed border closure by North Korea since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. Let's talk about this a little bit more with Frank Smith, who joins us from Seoul. Frank, so we know that North Korea is under severe sanctions, but perhaps it's something that's not highlighted, how that is impacting the country. Given the fact that we're looking at food shortages worldwide based on a variety of reasons, one of them, of course, the Ukraine conflict, what is the status when it comes to North Korea and food in general? And, of course, this particular proposal that the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, has set forward.
Well, if we go back to North Korea's food shortage problem, you know, it's been a chronic problem for the government in North Korea to provide food for its people. North Korea, where estimates of 3 million people died. Now, connecting this problem of chronic Korea sanctions, we need to look at where those sanctions are applied, how those sanctions are applied, what they affect. And sometimes there's, you know, it's difficult to make a connection between the item that's sanctioned or the category of items that are sanctioned and food shortages. The main example that I want to use here is oil. So, you know, it's suggested that by denying North Korea access to oil, you're going to affect its ability to pursue its, you know, missile and nuclear technologies and force the regime into negotiations on that issue. That's the reason behind these U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions. But oil is an integral element for North Korean food production, so it has a direct impact on how much food can be produced by North Korea and feed its people. We had some other information about the food shortage in North Korea that suggested they had cut rationing from just over 600 grams to 620 grams per person to under 600 grams per person. This is for the military, 580 grams per person. So this is having a quantitative effect on the, you know, sustenance that's being provided to the North Korean people. There are also some other elements that we need to look at here. You know, you mentioned the border closure. North Korea was perhaps the first country to shut down its border in January of 2020 with the COVID-19 pandemic beginning. And that shutting of its border with China affects its food production. It affects its ability to feed its people. Things like farming equipment and spare parts, again, that's going to affect their ability to produce food. Also, there has been flooding in North Korea over the years 2020, 2022, I believe, as well, and that has affected food production there. So there are a number of influences, but certainly the sanctions are one of the primary influences affecting North Korea's ability to feed its people.
Thank you so much for that. Frank Smith, a correspondent from Seoul. Thank you. Tehran is host to the first memorial of martyrs of resistance media, entitled Narrators of Resistance. In an address to the event, head of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting, Peyman Jebeli, said resistance is not a cost, it is an investment. Our correspondent Saman Khujuri reports.
Egypt's Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. In the meeting, the top diplomat conveyed Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's message of solidarity to Assad and all Syrians affected by the recent earthquakes. He also expressed Cairo's keenness on bolstering historic relations between Syria and Egypt, as well as boosting joint cooperation.
The first memorial of martyrs of resistance media, entitled Narrators of Resistance, has been held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. The families of media martyrs from Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, Palestine, and Lebanon attended the event. Addressing the ceremony, the commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Quds Force, Brigadier General Ismail Ghani, praised the martyrs of resistance media as a treasure which must be well invested.
The media presence of our martyrs makes them convey the sublime values that led them to achieve the goal of martyrdom. The global arrogance led by the U.S. promotes that those who own money and the biggest weapons are to emerge victorious in wars. However, despite its limited capabilities, the media of the resistance front succeeded in conveying the voice of truth.
Moreover, speaking at the event, head of the IRIB, Dr. Jebeli, honored the media martyrs on the resistance front.
In hard war, the enemy seeks to destroy our fortifications and force us to retreat from one place to another. But in soft war, the enemy does not use weapons, bombardment, and physically does not seek to push us back from one area to another, but seeks to mislead us, change our thinking, distort reality, and take us away from the straight path. We proudly pay for our resistance, but I would like to say that resistance not only costs nothing, but is a total investment. The participants believe that along with the war launched against the axis of resistance in the military sphere, the U.S. and the Zionist regime have also been using all means in the media sphere to undermine the resistance.
The participants believe that along with the war launched against the axis of resistance in the military sphere, the U.S. and the Zionist regime have also been using all means in the media sphere to undermine the resistance. Journalists of resistance media, as the narrators of resistance and truth, shed light on the realities on the ground in conflict zones, the realities which have been repeatedly ignored by mainstream media outlets of the West, led by the United States. Saman Khujuri, Tehran.
And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
The United States has made huge profits from the war in Ukraine, whereas Europe can be called the big loser of this war. These days, all over Europe, from France to Germany, Britain, Italy, Romania, and the Czech Republic, there have been massive protests against the war in Ukraine. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website of China Daily has covered this story and tells us more. As the US and its allies supply more weapons to Ukraine, peace activists have voiced their objections and are organizing demonstrations across Europe and the United States, calling for a halt to the escalation of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Stop the War Coalition, an advocacy group in the United Kingdom, is mobilizing people to go to the streets in central London in the coming days to demand peace talks and oppose warmongering in the name of military support. Stop the War Coalition said the London demonstration, which was held on Saturday, 25th of February, was part of a Europe-wide weekend of action, starting in Italy on Friday, 24th of February, with a 24-kilometre march from Perugia to Assisi. Raffaella Bollini of the Italian peace movement estimated that there will be protests in at least 100 towns and cities in the coming days. She said, "Feeling in Italy is running high against supplying arms to Ukraine, the movement is mobilizing everywhere." According to the coalition, demonstrations are planned for seven cities in Portugal. In Vienna, Austria, there was a protest on Saturday, 25th of February, and another in Zurich, Switzerland, in the coming days. Protests will be staged in 20 cities, including in Berlin, with action in Brussels in the coming days and protests across France throughout the weekend. Lindsay German, a convener of the coalition, said at an online rally ahead of the planned demonstrations that Europe is sleepwalking into a much wider conflict by sending more weapons to Ukraine. Meanwhile, Britain has hosted a program to train Ukrainian soldiers, and Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has announced that it will train Ukrainian jet pilots. On the other side of the Atlantic, Media Benjamin, founder of the peace group Code Pink, has been on a 50-day speaking tour of the United States, trying to stoke opposition to supplying weapons to Ukraine. Media Benjamin said, "What comes after that? Is it troops? Is that nuclear weapons? So-called leaders in the West are taking us directly into either a wider world war or a nuclear war." Many peace organizations are coming out to oppose the escalation of the conflict. Kate Hudson, General Secretary of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, said arms manufacturers are benefiting from this conflict at the cost of the people, not only those of Ukraine and Russia who are dying, but also people in the countries sending weapons. Kate Hudson added, "Untold billions are being spent by governments who then also say there is no money for public services or for decent wages." Press TV has also covered this issue and tells us more. Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets in London and Paris, as well as other major capitals across Europe, demanding an end to the ongoing war in Ukraine and urging Western governments to stop supplying Kiev with more weapons. The demonstrations took place in the major European capitals on Saturday, 25th of February, a day after an ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine entered its second year. The Saturday rally in London was organized by Stop the War Coalition. It was held at Portland Place in the city's central area, from which the participants marched towards Trafalgar Square. The London rally was attended by Jeremy Corbyn, a former Labour Party leader and a current member of the Parliament. Jeremy Corbyn called on world leaders to unite their action in order to bring peace to Ukraine. He said, "Hatred, poverty, terrorism and refugees are all fruits of war," warning that a new conflict will be just around the corner if world leaders do nothing about the current war in Ukraine. The protesters in London also chanted anti-war slogans whilst holding banners calling for an end to what the West's incessant campaign of pumping weapons into Ukraine. Kiev's Western allies have so far provided it with billions of dollars worth of heavy arms. Moscow has repeatedly warned that arming Ukraine will only prolong the conflict and add to the suffering of its people. Dalia Sanchez, an anti-war activist, said, "I don't agree with sending weapons to Ukraine because it prolongs the war," adding that Western military alliance of NATO and Russia should engage in talks to prevent more escalation and more deaths. John Clark, another anti-war demonstrator, said NATO's eastward expansion was not right. John Clark said, "I'm here today just because I think we need to stop warmongering and we need to reconsider what is happening." In Paris, France, hundreds of people demonstrated against the war in Ukraine while singing Ukraine's national anthem at Place de la République. According to French police, the rally attracted around 3,000 participants. Other demonstrations simultaneously took place in other French cities, such as Bordeaux, Rennes and Montpellier, as well as in other European capitals, such as Berlin, Germany and Brussels, Belgium. The German national broadcaster Deutsche Welle has covered this story and tells us more. Thousands of people have taken part in a demonstration in the German capital Berlin against supplying Ukraine with more weapons, a day after the first anniversary of the Russia-Ukraine confrontation. German police said about 10,000 people gathered in central Berlin on Saturday, 25th of February, calling for negotiations with Russia rather than escalating the war by supplying Kiev with more weapons. The protest organizers said on their website, "We call on Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz to stop the escalation of arms deliveries to Ukraine now, because every day lost costs up to 1,000 more lives and brings us closer to a third world war." One sign held by the demonstrators said, "Negotiate, not escalate," while a banner in the crowd read, "Not our war." Police mobilized 1,400 police officers to keep peace in Berlin. Meanwhile, in the French capital, Paris, several hundred people gathered at Place de la République, calling for an end to the war in Ukraine. The demonstrations came a day after thousands of people took to the streets across Europe to mark 1 year since Russia launched its special operation in Ukraine. Since then, the United States and the European Union have supplied Ukraine with tens of billions of dollars worth of weaponry, including rocket systems, drones, armored vehicles, tanks, and communication systems, despite Russia's repeated warning that the Western military assistance to Ukraine will only prolong the conflict. A recent opinion poll suggests the majority of the German people see their country's arms deliveries to Ukraine as participation in the war against Russia. The opinion poll was conducted on behalf of Germany's Deutsche Press Agentur news agency by the opinion research institute YouGov. It surveyed 2,072 Germans nationwide from 21st to 23rd of February, ahead of the one-year anniversary of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. 51% of the respondents in the survey thought arming Ukraine meant being part of the war. Germany has approved some 2.6 billion euros worth of weaponry and armament since the start of the war. Germany is considered the fourth biggest arms supplier to Ukraine since the war started a year ago, after United States, Britain, and Poland.
Choose to think better. Welcome to A Better You. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. While the G7 nations continue to back the brutal Zionist entity, support for the Palestinian cause from around the world continues to grow. Latest figures from the United Nations indicate that 138 out of 193 member states have recognised Palestine's sovereignty over the West Bank and Gaza. And nations across Latin America in particular are strongly supportive of the Palestinian resistance. We'll be exploring why that support is so strong after this report by Latifa Abouchakra about Latin America's solidarity with Palestine.
Latin America is a hub of support for the Palestinian cause, from Venezuela to Brazil to Chile. The call for the liberation of Palestine is a powerful force to be reckoned with. There have been many examples of Latin American leaders taking strong stands to support the Palestinian resistance. On the political level, Chile, Paraguay, Brazil, Argentina, Bolivia, Uruguay, Ecuador, and Venezuela have all recognized Palestinian sovereignty over the West Bank and Gaza. Chile is home to almost 500,000 Palestinians, who constitute around 2.5% of the country's population. The feeling of solidarity with Palestine in Chile is palpable, and while significant Israeli interests do exist in Chilean society, there have been some interesting developments. In 2022, the newly elected president of Chile, Gabriel Boric, cancelled the credentials ceremony for the new Israeli ambassador and promptly dismissed him from the presidential palace when he heard of the Israeli military killing of Odia Salah in Jenin. It has since been announced that a Chilean embassy will be established in Palestine. Aside from the political side of the equation, there are also material connections between the resistance and Latin America. But there have even been several fighters from Latin America who joined the ranks of Palestinian resistance groups and directly participated in operations like Carlos the Jackal, who attempted to assassinate the vice president of the British Zionist Federation at his home in London. The late great president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, refused to condemn Carlos the Jackal, even under pressure from the French embassy, stating that he was a good friend and a steadfast fighter for the Palestinian people. The US government and other nefarious actors have long accused Hugo Chavez of harboring active cells for the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah in Venezuela. It was alleged that Chavez provided safe haven to the only group which has successfully driven Israel out of Lebanon, the resistance group Hezbollah, in the Venezuelan territory of Margarita Island. The current Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, who himself has been the target of several U.S. assassination attempts, has publicly spoken of his close relationship with the late resistance leader, General Qasem Soleimani. Maduro claims that when Venezuela was subject to U.S. cyber attacks, it was Soleimani who came and secured Venezuela's systems from North American skullduggery. When asked about his country's commitment to the liberation of Palestine, Maduro responded, "No one in this world dares ask us to abandon Palestine. It is a sin just thinking about abandoning Palestine. Palestine is the sacred land of mankind. Israel's crimes against the Palestinian people will be paid for by the occupation one day." Despite Israel's best attempts to subvert the will of billions across the world, Palestine is not alone, and Latin America stands firmly with it.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller, who's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University. David's a director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's recently been appointed as a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zaim University. Our guest expert today is Pablo Navarrete. Pablo is a journalist and a documentary filmmaker. His work includes Inside the Revolution, A Journey into the Heart of Venezuela, and No Extradition, which traces the struggle of Julian Assange's father for his son's freedom. And we spoke to Pablo earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, which of the governments in Latin America, in your opinion, would you say have been, you know, the most supportive, stood out in their support for Palestine?
Well, as we heard in the film there, there's quite a lot of the Latin American countries have recognised the Palestinian state. And indeed, many of the countries who come from a tradition of struggle against authoritarianism, they're the ones who are most likely to be supporting the Palestinians. Obviously, Venezuela is a standout case, and the Venezuelans have been absolutely at the front of absolute support for the Palestinian cause, and indeed for the support of other armed movements around about West Asia, including in Lebanon with Hezbollah. The Chilean government recently, of course, the new Chilean leader sent back the new Israeli ambassador as a result of the killings of the IDF in the territories. And of course, even let's go further back, I mean, countries like Nicaragua and Cuba and indeed Bolivia more recently have been very supportive of the Palestinian cause.
Well, it certainly set the standard, I think, for the rest of the world, in my opinion. But anyway, we asked Pablo about Chile's bond with Palestine and how deep it actually runs.
Okay, so I'm the son of Chilean political refugees. I'm born and raised in the UK. Now, Chile is the country that has the biggest Palestinian population outside the Arab world. And there are between 300,000 to 500,000 Palestinians, is estimated. And take into account that Chile has just under 20 million people. So it's not an insignificant population. Now, the roots of this population date back to the late 1800s, Christian enclaves around Bethlehem, Palestinians that left for Latin America. But principally, the population in Chile came after the First World War. Again, Christian predominantly that settled in Chile. And initially, it was a kind of more secular, progressively orientated in terms of politics population. But as it has embedded itself, many have done very well with business. And this population has become, in terms of at least of the representation, which is estimated to be about 6,000 Palestinians that form a kind of body, a Palestinian body that represent the community, which is, again, not much, 6,000 out of potentially 500,000. But this representative body is more conservative, has close ties to Chile's elite. So I think also interesting to think about is expressions of concrete solidarity with Chile. And here, I think it's worth mentioning the Palestinian Football Club of Chile's first division that was created in the 1920s and has, you know, if you go today to the stadium, you will see Palestinian flags, one of the only places where you'll see the Palestinian flag wave freely. And, you know, chants of Gaza resists, Palestine exists.
David, Latifa referred to the legendary Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez in her report. I mean, just tell us what his stance was on Israel.
Well, Chavez was an uncompromising advocate of the Palestinian cause. I think one of the things you've got to remember here is that the scepticism that there is on the left in Europe and parts of the world towards Islamic revolution is not held so strongly in Latin America. They come from a Christian background, predominantly Catholic, yes, but they're much more able to understand that religion can play a role in revolution than is the left in Western Europe, I think. And that's partly because of the role of the Christianity in the liberation struggles in Latin America. So we see a much easier connection between Palestinian liberation and the liberation movements of Latin America. And that's something which, you know, Chavez, socialist that he was, understood very well.
Indeed. Well, I also asked Pablo to outline the attitude of the new Chilean government about Palestine.
In December 2021, a former student leader turned lawmaker, Gabriel Boric, won the Chilean presidential election, and he won it against a far-right politician who was the son of a Nazi army officer. Cast was the surname, and someone that openly said he still admired the fascist US-backed dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet that ruled between 1973 and 1990. So Gabriel Boric is someone that, as a lawmaker, has effectively supported levels of BDS, has come out denouncing Israel in the past. And his government, since March 2022, I was in Chile when he became president, has made a number of symbolic gestures, which I think are important, but perhaps shouldn't be overstated. There was there were credentials for the new Israeli ambassador that were essentially postponed in September after the latest killings by the Israeli government of Palestinians. But that, again, much was made of that. But 2 weeks later, Boric, the government, apologized and did accept the credentials.
David, what do we know about the links between Venezuela and Hezbollah, which, of course, as we know, has been proscribed in this country?
So the Venezuelans have been very supportive of Hezbollah, as they have of the Palestinians. And, both Maduro and Chavez have said, you know, we will not be abandoning our allies. And these are people who they regard as comrades in arms and not as terrorists or as Islamic fundamentalists, as many people on the left in Western Europe would say.
I mean, Latifa also referred to a character known as Carlos the Jackal.
What do we know about him? I remember there's quite a bit of publicity about him about 30 years ago.
So Carlos was one of these sort of fictional terrorists for the Western media, someone who's so bad that even the mention of his name was enough to get to the front page of the tabloid press. Now, of course, he was a Palestinian guerrilla, and you know, unlike many people in Western Europe, the people in Latin America who support Palestinian liberation weren't willing to just throw people under the bus because they were engaged in armed struggle. So that's the key thing. There's an unflinching ability to say, no, we stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Mm. It's curious, isn't it? Because, as I mentioned, there was lots of publicity, I remember, at the time. I mean, why do you think it is that the Western media sort of focus on a character like Carlos the Jackal?
Well, they have to create the idea that there are these individuals who are motivated by some kind of personal animus or by some kind of religious drive, and that these are people who are in some way mad. That's what the whole idea of terrorism really is that these people are committing terror against civilians, they will say, and they're not engaged in struggle against military forces. And the problem with these people is not just that they have a belief and they're fighting in relation to what they regard as justice, but they are somehow mad, right? Mm. And that's the idea. That's why you have Carlos the Jackal. You have this name to indicate he's kind of like a serial killer. Like that's the way they want to make it. These are people are mad and bad, and not people who are motivated by a political motivation, which of course was the reality.
No, indeed. And of course, another legendary Latin American figure, Fidel Castro, of course, someone else who I think has stood out in solidarity, you know, with revolutionary struggles in Palestine.
That's right, in Palestine and indeed in other places. I remember Che, of course, travelled to Africa to support revolution there.
Che Guevara, of course. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'm just going to pause the conversation there now for a moment because we've got another quite shocking report, actually, about the relationship between the previous far-right president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, and the Israeli regime.
Many have questioned who the most pro-Israel Latin American leader has been. The winner of that dubious competition may well be former Brazilian president and military officer Jair Bolsonaro. It is believed that his emotional promotion of the Zionist project stems from his aim to ingratiate himself with his Christian evangelical electoral base. But Bolsonaro has gone over and above his servility to Israel. At Palestine Declassified, we question if Bolsonaro has facilitated the penetration of Brazil's armed forces by Israeli intelligence. Benjamin Netanyahu was the first Israeli political leader to visit Brazil following the election of Bolsonaro. He proudly hosted Netanyahu at a synagogue in Rio de Janeiro, where they announced a brotherhood between their countries with the intent of increasing economic, military, and technological integration. Bolsonaro bestowed upon Netanyahu the highest national honor for visiting political figures, and the Brazilian Post Office released a special stamp to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the establishment of the Zionist entity, featuring a picture of Netanyahu next to the word Savior in Hebrew. Bolsonaro was in turn crowned with a Friends of Zion Award in occupied Al-Quds. The family bonds between the Bolsonaros and Israel are so strong that the former Brazilian president's sons have been pictured wearing IDF t-shirts, and his wife even delivered her vote in the most recent election wearing a t-shirt emblazoned with the Israeli flag. The most sinister part of this story is Bolsonaro's role in submitting the data of the Brazilian army to an Israeli cybersecurity company with an umbilical relationship to Israeli intelligence. In March 2022, the Israeli company CySource signed an agreement to train the Brazilian military in cyber defense. The CEO and founder of the company is Amir Barel, who is reported to have worked for Israel's external intelligence service, Mossad, before entering the private sector. He also previously worked with the Israeli spy company, NSO Group, which developed the Pegasus software that has hacked the phones of journalists, human rights defenders, and politicians around the world. CySource is also part of the Israeli cyber companies consortium led by the arms company Israel Aerospace Industries. The consortium was founded in 2016 by Israel's Ministry of the Economy to, quote-unquote, provide an overarching solution by Israeli cyber companies to the needs of different national-level cyber agencies. In addition to granting this deal to CISORCE, a Brazilian lieutenant from the military, Luiz Katzap, was appointed as the global sales director of the Israeli company. How can the Brazilian military protect its sovereignty from Israeli espionage?
David, would you say that Bolsonaro takes the award as the most pro-Israel Latin American leader probably in history?
Possibly in history. I mean, he is clearly very strongly pro-Israel. And you saw that his son's there with the IDF T-shirts and the Mossad T-shirts you can buy in Israeli airports as you travel into the country. I'm not sure if they sell them to just everyone, but they are certainly available. But let's think back in history. I mean, the Israelis have a strong record of intervening in Latin America. And back in the days when the military ran Argentina, there was a strong role there. The Israelis supplied weapons to the military dictatorship there, including in a period when the dictatorship was rounding up Jews. And the Israelis didn't balk at that. They still supplied the weapons. So there's been a long history of involvement. And, of course, what they're doing in Brazil now is trying to penetrate the Brazilian military to get the data. I mean, anyone who thinks that these cybersecurity companies are just there for business reasons hasn't thought for more than 2 minutes about it. I mean, this is a conscious effort by Israeli intelligence to branch out into the corporate world and to use the corporate results for Israeli intelligence's own benefit. So, you know, certainly Bolsonaro is a very strong pro-Israel character, but he's not the only one by any means.
Well, I asked Pablo what he could tell us about the farcical Venezuelan opposition figure, Juan Guaido, and his relationship with Israel.
Yeah, Juan Guaido was a far-right, again, politician, sort of a bit of a nobody, really, in Venezuela, known by only 20% of the population when it was decided by the US and others that he would be the latest attempt to effect regime change in Venezuela, something they've been trying since 1999 when Hugo Chavez first came to power. And obviously under Chavez, you know, support for Palestine and Palestinians' resistance against the savagery of Israel and what it does daily in Palestine went up many notches. And obviously Israel viewed Venezuela under Chavez as a threat. And so Guaido was this, you know, self sort of pathetic figure, really, that decided that he'd call himself the president with the support of the UK and the US and other sort of imperial states. And even though now the opposition have discarded him, he's still someone that the UK, I think, recognises as the president. It's all sort of farcical and pathetic. But he, you know, when he declared himself president in February 2019, he said he would restore diplomatic relations with Israel immediately, obviously, something that had been, you know, not been the case for 10 years prior under Chavez, broke diplomatic relations. He said he would open an embassy. And so he was really kind of, you know, very much a puppet for US imperialism, for what Israel is attempting also to do in the region. But really, he's just a sort of a washed out figure now that has no relevance, but, you know, continues to be, you know, thought of as some kind of president by people in London and in Washington.
David, what else can you tell us about CISORCE that was mentioned in the last package about Bolsonaro?
So CISORCE is a cyber defence company. We've seen on the show a number of different cyber defence companies and tech companies which have been, you know, rolled out of Israeli intelligence. And the plan clearly is, with all of these companies, is that you create these commercial vehicles, you staff them with ex-intelligence officers who then will have some kind of relationship with Mossad or even with Shin Bet internally in the Zionist entity. So if you look at it from the point of view of Mossad sitting in Tel Aviv, and they have all these different cyber defense companies and cybersecurity companies and tech firms, CISORCE is one of them, there's many others we've looked at in this program, what you see is the ability to try and penetrate the information infrastructure of different countries. In the UK, for example, we saw only the other week we did a show on Oracle, the Zionist firm in America, penetrating the Ministry of Defense in this country. And this is what SciSource is up to in Brazil. It's about penetrating the data, which allows them to penetrate into the fabric of the running of the Brazilian